Here's what I want us to do. I want you to take out your phones, and I'm serious. For those of you with a mobile device, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to scroll through your contacts. Just start scrolling. Open them up and call the first, no, don't do that. Just open them up and just start scrolling through the names. I want you to notice how many people you know, or at least have some sort of connection. The fact that they gave you their number meant that they probably trust you to some level in their life, right? In the last decade, as you scroll through those names, hear this, the last decade, there has been a tremendous decline in the church. And I'm not just talking about the chairs at Mars Hill, these gray chairs. I'm talking about also the capital C church. I was talking to one of our lay pastors a few weeks ago who said that the United Methodist denomination in the next 10 years will close half of their church doors. That's a big deal. That's a lot of doors. Those represented at one point a lot of people. And that's happening in denominations all over the West. The decline of church attendance in the West and commitment is happening for about as many reasons as there are stars in the Milky Way. So for the first 3 weeks in January, I want to help us reclaim some things, maybe that have been lost or that have been missing or that have been confused or that have been mishandled in our time. And so I want to do this conversation in January called Reclamation for 3 weeks. And in week one, I'm going to be looking at what does it mean to reclaim faith in an age of cynicism? What does it mean to come back to a place of awe and wonder that faith is inevitable in life? That we don't sort of choose or not choose faith. We have to place faith in whatever it is that you're living in. So where do you place faith? Where do our friends, where do the people in our contact list place faith? What does it mean to reclaim wonder? The second week, I want to look at reclaiming narratives, specifically the Bible, in an age of deconstruction, in an age of relativity. Can we trust Scripture? Is it a true story? Is it a story worth giving our lives to? Is it a story above all stories that demands your loyalty, your allegiance, such as the Beatitudes? And for that, I'm flying in some friends of ours from Portland that founded what's called the Bible Project. And they're doing incredible work right now of reclaiming story in our time when everything has become individualized and relativized. And so I'm really, really pretty pumped about that January 14, about them being here. They'll do a workshop that evening where they're going to be debuting another film. And a lot of it has to do with how do we process story and get this story inside of us so that we can live out that story in the world. In week three, we're going to be talking about reclaiming the beauty of the church within a culture of hyper-individualism. How do we create a sort of hope once again in trust with society when so much of the trust with the church has been broken for this, that, and the other, right? And so like moments like we just had with Leslie, like those sorts of moments need to happen more in our lives. And the church needs to be that place in which those types of things happen all the time. And so, we don't do billboards here, thanks be to God. We don't spend money on mailers for sermon series. You're welcome. We have always been a word of mouth community. And so if you are lamenting any gray chairs in this place, we enlist you to consider yourself invited, to invite someone into this conversation we want to have. Because what happens is where God is moving, people talk about that. It always sort of engenders conversation. And the amount of emails I get on a regular basis in this place of people who are being stirred and moved and transformed means that I think that there's much to talk about in this place. And so is there at least one person in your contacts that you just scrolled through who God has mysteriously connected you with and that you have the kind of rapport and trust that it's time to leverage that and to actually take a risk and invite them, knowing that this series is designed to be welcoming and engaging and that they are wanted in this place. And so I just want to submit that to you to consider. So that being said, Psalm 126 is where we are together today. It's the candle of joy. Is there anyone interested in more joy? I know I am very interested in joy. What I want to do is read this like we did last week in terms of an antiphon. So let's get this half of the room once again with the white lettering, and this half of the room once again with the green. And let's just get this scripture. It's this psalm. It's six simple verses that we're just going to sort of dive into and allow to see what comes up out of them. So let's read this together. Let's start on this side. When the Lord restored. Our mouths. This psalm is a promise, and I want to lean into that promise today. Dallas Willard said something once, one of my favorite theologians who passed away a few years ago. He said something that I think is true, that if you bury yourself in the psalms, you emerge knowing God and understanding life. And I think there's something about the ways that the psalms are able to carry the cries of the heart, right? It's more than just doctrine. It's more than just, it's to say, like, this is the longing of my heart. Not everything is as it should be. How do I live in that tension? How do I live in that moment? How do I carry faith throughout the course of my life, knowing that I'm disappointed time after time after time? So 126, if I could give this psalm in an image, behold, children of God, it would be this. This is what this psalm is. The first three verses look at the past. They look at what God has been up to. They look at sort of looking backward in life. And the second half of the psalm is about looking forward. Both of those are directions in our community. So let me give a little context. I want to start with the first three verses. This was written in the time of Ezra, if you'll go to that next slide. It was written in the time of Ezra, a time where the people had been released. Now, the people of Israel had been in Babylonian captivity for years. And Cyrus of the Persians conquers them surprisingly. No one expected that. And when Cyrus did, he was gracious with the Jewish people. And he sent them back. He allowed them to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild their temple, to rebuild their prosperity, to rebuild their community, to rebuild shalom. And it was a fascinating, strange time. And the feeling was surprise. And what came out of them was utter joy. And so that's what's happening in these first three verses, that what the psalmist is looking back on wasn't something that was back in the days of Moses way back then. It actually was a part of their lifetime, that they had lived in that, and they knew what it was like to be full of joy when something happened, that when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. In other words, they were saying, is this really happening? Could it be this good? Am I actually dreaming? I was thinking about a time this week where I felt like that in my life, and I was trying to think, when have I felt like I was actually dreaming? So let me give you a woefully inadequate illustration, and here's a warning. It's a sports analogy, which is so cliche, and I hate telling them, but it goes like this. The year was 2013. It was eons ago, or more like, not like decades, more like 4 years. Okay, we'll call it 4 years. 4 years ago in 2013, it was a college basketball regional final. And underranked Michigan was taking on Kansas. And Kansas dominated the first 34 of the 40 minutes. Does anyone know what I'm talking about here? A couple of you, right? Michigan's point guard, Trey Burke, this sort of tiny little guy, right? He looked like a small child in comparison to the trees of Kansas, right? And I don't know where they find these people that are this tall. Probably some of you, like the Dutch people, West Michigan, they come up here and they recruit. Just crazy height. And so Trey is so tiny. And the last 6 minutes of the game, they start like chipping away at the lead. And if you're anything like me, like if you're a Michigan fan, you know that like this doesn't happen to us. Comebacks are what happen to everyone else's team. They don't happen to the Michigan Wolverines. And they start chipping away at this lead in the last 6 minutes. And it was this moment where Trey Burke pulls up for this ridiculous three, and it actually goes in. And we're all just sitting here looking at each other like, we were like those who dreamed. Like, this just doesn't happen to our team. We sat there in silence, and we felt like this was redonkulous. And overtime they go, and Michigan actually wins the game. And it was just one of those moments where you're like, are we dreaming here? Like I said, a woefully inadequate illustration. A better one might go something like this. I remember being in church with a friend of mine who was Egyptian the week the Arab Spring happened. And they were liberated from Mubarak. And he could not contain his joy. I remember so many of my black friends when Obama was inaugurated saying, no, AJ, you don't get it as a white guy. We never thought this would happen. And here is the moment. That kind of joy that you could not contain, that was sort of surprised. It was as if the Israelites said, remember that moment when we dreamed and we never thought it was possible, but it came to fruition. So imagine this sort of surprise joy bubbling up that wasn't expected. And the psalmist goes on to say that remember that time long ago. He said, remember our mouths were filled with laughter and our tongues with songs of joy. In other words, that the tongue couldn't even contain it. James talks a lot about this in the Epistle of James, how the tongue is this powerful force that almost seemingly has a mind of its own. There's these three words for joy in the Hebrew. The first one is masos. And masos is this idea of rejoicing, but it's not strong enough, so the psalmist doesn't use it here. The second word is simha. It's this idea of gladness, someone that's walking around that just has gladness in their countenance, but it's not strong enough. And so the psalmist employs this word that's not used a lot. It's the word renah. And renah is this loud cry that what we see in the psalmist here is the first testimony of the charismatics. This is the first moment where the Pentecostal, charismatic, ancient people of God could not contain themselves, and they just burst out into joy, spontaneous outbursts of laughter and song, saying, it is so good that we cannot keep it in. Next passage says, then it was said among the nations that the Lord has done great things for them. In other words, you know your God is good when other nations that don't believe in your God are praising your God because of what's happening to you. Like, that's when you know you're in a moment of renah, a moment of joy that you can't contain, and others are envious because of the things that are happening in life. Verse 3, the Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. In other words, they begin to name it, that it's not just the nations, but we name that God has been good to us, that this is the power of nostalgia. This is the power of looking backward and claiming some of those things to say, we're not just like here in a vacuum. We're the sum total of our stories of how God has released us from certain captivities and has brought us into a moment of renewal. Looking backward and remembering God. And then what happens is this. The text suddenly shifts to the future. If you'd pull up that next slide. We go from verses 1 through 3 where it's looking backward to verses 4 through 6 where they're longing forward toward a fully renewed Jerusalem. The text says this, verse 4, restore our fortunes, O Lord. Would you do that? In other words, there's a future tense here, like the streams of Negev. In the Hebrew, this word streams is afik. And in the streams of Negev, every once in a while, there would be these torrential flood rains. And it would bubble up in the Negev, the desertous region. And it would come up from the ground, and you would just sense like there's an overflow that we did not expect. And the place where we thought dryness was our only future, there was water. There was release. There was life and joy. And it leads us to verse 5 and 6 where we're going to camp. Those who sow with tears will reap songs of joy. There's this fascinating intersection here between sowing and reaping, sowing in sorrow and reaping in joy. Verse 6 is a repetition of that. Those who go out weeping and carrying seed to sow will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. Okay, two things are happening in this text we've made very clear. There's a looking back and there's a longing forward. And here's the problem with this psalm. You can't live there. Nobody does. Because we all live in the present. It's one thing to look back and to say, that was incredible. It's another thing to look forward and to say, God, would you in our time? And the problem is that we don't live in either of those places, that we live here and now. And many of you feel that way. You feel like you have this moment where you can remember life as it was and life as you hope it will be. But you're somewhere in between. And like that mall marquee directory, you are here, right? And maybe here isn't exactly where you want to be in life. This is the perfect Advent text. This sort of tension of already and not yet. Of Lord, we believed in this and we believe this will happen, but what do we do in between? Asking questions like, well, that's fine, I get joy in my past and I believe joy in my future, but where is joy in this moment? Asking even better questions about the incarnation, is God still with us? Has God left us? And here's where this gets really interesting. In verse 5 and 6, there seems to be something about the inseparable connection between sorrow and joy. Let me say that again, because that's not something that's like common wisdom. That there seems to be a connection the psalmist is making between sorrow and joy. I think it's easy when we're in seasons of sorrow to think something is deeply wrong with us. That somehow in my sorrow, I'm alone. That God doesn't see me, that I feel abandoned and betrayed, and there must be something wrong with my life. And I think the psalmist, I think what he's saying is twofold. The first is this, that sorrow is not actually the enemy of joy. That those two things aren't incompatible together. And I think often we pit them one against the other. That for me to have joy, there needs to be an absence of sorrow. And because there's not an absence of sorrow, something's wrong with my life. That's often how the equation works out in our subconscious. That sorrow is not actually the thief of joy. If there's one thing that you can count on in this life, it's sorrow. It's pain. It's hardship at some point. It's grief. It's sadness. But the story of life, the story of your life, is going somewhere. At least that's what the text tells us. That sorrow doesn't have the final word. And the second thing I think that the psalmist wants to tell us is that somehow, mysteriously, sorrow plays a part in preparing us for whatever future that is. That somehow, without whatever sorrow that we are holding, whatever sorrow we have experienced, somehow we won't be prepared for whatever that future might be. And so sorrow serves as a kind of preparatory soil to reap that which we long for. I think what happens is this. Let me just clarify. What I'm not saying is this. I'm not saying God is the author of sorrow. I am saying God is the restorer of it. And I think Leslie would attest to that. That God is not the author of whatever sorrow you're holding. We believe in a good God. But God does know how to edit that and lead into a kind of future. But I think what happens in sorrow in my life is that sorrow makes us sober. It wakens us from the illusions of life that we're so prone to so willfully walk into. Our entertainment value, the way we're distracted, the things that we settle for, that we think will bring us fulfillment, that always overpromise and underdeliver. And what sorrow does is it knocks me out of my sort of stupor and it awakens the soul to long for what is true. And what the psalmist wants to say is this: if you are in a season of sorrow, God is sowing something deep. But you got to look for it. And you got to cooperate with it. See, if you're anything like me, I want to detour that and get to whatever happy ending I'm hoping is on the other side. The season the Israelites found themselves in was one of rebuilding. And here's the thing. As they found themselves, if you go to that next slide, you'll find themselves as they're rebuilding, things aren't actually going well. They experience setbacks, right? The adrenaline that they once felt when they left Babylon and were freed from Cyrus, they had all this adrenaline. It had faded, and division was breaking out, and the community's confused by their setbacks, and they're attempting to rebuild their lives. Not unlike Syrians heading back into Aleppo now that ISIS is gone, that we're trying to support, saying, we want a new future. We're not there. We have joy from being liberated from our ISIS occupiers, but we're somewhere in between. Maybe you know this experience personally. Rebuilding what has been destroyed is very hard. I meet people every single week who are in the midst of divorce, who are in the midst of some sort of conflict and struggle, who have this sort of idea of what God longs for them and have these stories of joy and renewal from the past, but yet they're living in a moment where those two things feel like light years away. How do I live? How do I experience joy? Sometimes it's in the form of a new job that you had all this anticipation for, and it's just sort of worn off, or a new location, or a new house, or a new child. Postpartum depression is such a real thing. You're like, I thought this was supposed to bring joy. Now I'm just exhausted, and I'm stressed, and I'm strained, and I have sleepless nights, and Christmas comes around, and many of us feel joyless. And so you hit the candle of joy and you're like, well, if God's given that, I'll take some, but I'm sort of not believing that it's going to happen, right? Shananiqua said something recently I thought was so beautiful. If you know her, you can just hear her voice saying this. Listen, sometimes joy is easy, a wellspring of its own. And sometimes you have to work for it. You have to pray and walk and tell the truth and get outside and write and love your people, read good books and work hard and hold on to hope. And there it is again, joy, worth every step of it. Like the stream of Negev, like a fig, it bubbles up. You cannot manufacture joy. It comes unexpectedly, and it's deeply satisfying. So let me just close with this. How do we attain joy? You know, I think that's the question. Okay, got it. So like, what do you want me to do? Just tell me what to do, and then joy will happen. It doesn't work like that. I don't think it's that mechanical. Here's what I do know. I know three things that will steal it from you. I don't know exactly how to get it. I think it gets you more than you get it. But I know what steals it. I know how to not get joy. We'll call them thieves of joy. Jesus taught about it. Open up your Shed Bibles to page 901. I'll just make three quick points from this. Matthew 13. It's not going to be on the screen. I'm just going to read it. Page 901, verse 3, Jesus told them many parables, saying, a farmer went out to sow a seed. Let me just stop there. A farmer went out to sow a seed. A farmer went out to sow his seed. Here's what Jesus, I think, is saying. God is sowing in your life right now. And last night and yesterday morning. And tomorrow afternoon, God is sowing in your life through experiences, through people, through situations, in everyday life. And Jesus doesn't want to discuss in this parable the quality of the seed. He wants to discuss the quality of the soil, the condition of the soil. In other words, your soul. And as this farmer, as God, was scattering seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Verse 18, skip over. Listen, Jesus says, to what the parable of the sower means. When anyone hears the message about the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what is sown in their heart, the seed sown along the path. The first thief of joy is this word, hurry. Hurry. If you want to not have joy, then keep hurrying through life. Don't slow down. Fill your calendar with entertainment and activities. See, joy is never in a hurry. It's never found in the superficial rush of the Christmas season. It's only and always found in the depths, often in the quiet, and often in the early hours of the day before the rush of the frenzy sets in. So here's an obvious question. Are you in a hurry? Are you in a hurry in life right now? Back to the text, Jesus goes on to tell another thief of joy. Some fell in the rocky places where it didn't have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched and they were withered because they had no root. The seed falling on the rocks refers, the seed falling on rocky ground refers to someone who hears the word and at once receives it with joy. But since they have no root, they last only a short time. When trouble or persecution comes, because of the word, they quickly fall away. Here's what the rocks mean. Here's the thief of joy in the rocks. It's immediacy. Immediacy. God really likes time. He made it. And he made it so that not everything had to happen at once. Like, well, wait, AJ. I thought we were supposed to expect God. Isn't that hope? Isn't God supposed to do stuff if we expect God to do things? I would just say be careful not to confuse expectancy with immediacy. Many have lost their faith because they've confused expectancy with immediacy, that God needs to do the future now. And if that doesn't happen, then I can't trust this God, right? Immediacy says God isn't performing on my timeline, so I'm out. Expectancy says I know God will do what God says in due time. See, expectancy has the maturity to wait. And there's something meaningful that's happening in us in the waiting. I find it really mysterious that even God submits to time. Like, isn't it strange that God, when God comes in flesh, spends 9 months in a human womb? I mean, you would think God would just be like, boom, I'm here, let's do some stuff, right? And he spends 9 months as the eternal Logos in a womb of a woman. That's profound, that's strange, that's instructive. Here's what Advent is designed to teach you. Friends of mine in sorrow, receive this. God does wonders in the dark. And some of you feel like you're in the dark, whatever that means. From the womb of Mary, the mother of Jesus, to the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, what we learn is this, that God does his best work in dark places. He's not left you. He's cultivating you to receive a kind of future that puts you in a position to where you will be mature enough to recognize it and to rest in it and to not exploit it. Last, other seed fell among the thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. The seeds, verse 22, the seed fell among the thorns refers to someone who hears the word. But the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth, it chokes the word, making it unfruitful. I think the last here is worry. Hurry, immediacy, and worry. If you don't want to have joy, choose these three realities. Worry about the future. I think the amount of control that we actually have on the future is staggeringly low. It's one thing to long for the future. It's another thing to try to live in it every day. Try to detour whatever you're in rather than going through it. So here's an obvious question. What are you worried about? What are you worried about? And here's a follow-up question. Is that worth your joy? Because it's stealing it every day. Here's the promise of the psalm. Those who go out weeping, carrying seeds to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. Looking back, in longing forward, but living present. As we come to the table today, I want to read the words of Alexander Schmemann. He's an Eastern Orthodox legend. And I try not to read large texts in here. I know that's not been the usual in our history, so this one's just two slides. It's worth every minute. From its very beginning, Christianity has been the proclamation of joy. At the bottom of darkness, with this joy, it transformed the end into a beginning. Cool. I mean, you could just sit with that all day. Of all accusations against Christians, the most terrible one was uttered by Nietzsche when he said that Christians had no joy. For behold, I bring you tidings of great joy. Thus begins the gospel. And here's where it ends. And they worshiped him and returned with Jerusalem with great joy. Ours is a religion of joy. We must, if possible, partake of this great joy before we discuss anything else. Programs, missions, projects, or techniques. Joy, however, is not something one can define or analyze. And here's where I think the beauty is. One enters into joy. And we have no other means of entering into that joy, no way of understanding it, except through the one action from which the beginning has been for the church, both the source and the fulfillment of joy, the very sacrament of joy, the Eucharist. Friends, today we come to this table with joy. And maybe that's new for you. You felt if you just felt bad enough, long enough, then maybe God would once again love you enough, and then you can take the sacrament. Yes, repentance is a part of it, turning the other way. But it's joy, is to say, I'm welcomed at the table. And not only that, but Jesus is setting a table for all the world. What a table of joy. What a communion. And so today, as you come to the table, come with a heart that can feast on what God is sowing in you, and that is seeds of joy. That whatever you're looking back to and whatever you're longing for, that we can at least hold the tension in the moment, allowing even our sorrows to be transformed.